Welcome to episode 98 of the Payers and Players podcast. My name is Robert. I'm here with Scott. Before we get started in today's podcast, and we've got kind of a different podcast, if you would, we'd appreciate if you'd go give us a follow on Twitter. We also have the ability for you to subscribe if you're so inclined. We really appreciate all of our subscribers. But in today's episode, we've got something special. So we took our boys to the country of Colombia to play three ITF tournaments in a row. And in today's podcast, we did three different reflections, basically walking through the complete experience. What is it like playing on red clay? What is it like with line calls? What was it like from an expense perspective? What is ITF like altogether? So in today's episode, you get kind of three sections. And the first one, we're sitting at the tournament. The second one, we're another day at the tournament. And then the third one, I think we're in our Airbnb. But the total podcast is an hour. But it really walks through our entire experience playing ITF tournaments in the country of Colombia. We played in three cities, one in Bogota, one in Ibagué, and one in Pereira. And so we hope you enjoy our reflections on playing three ITFs in a row. And so with that, let's jump right into our three reflections. All right, we're on here live. I'm sitting with Scott. We're coming to you from Ibagué, Colombia.
South America. Robert, what are we doing here?
Well, I don't know. You tell me.
I'm with you, so I'm following you. So why am I following you to Ibagué?
So I think it was mutually beneficial, but we were looking at ITFs. I think there's a general misconception that ITFs are only for the tip top of players and juniors in America. And I think it's also a misconception that they're ultra expensive. And so we got to looking at some Colombian ITFs, one in Bogota, one in Ibagué, and one in Pereira. And we noticed that accommodations were super cheap. The tournaments were extremely affordable. So the entry for the tournament for qualifying main and doubles is $55 total. We booked our Airbnb, three bedrooms, two baths in Bogota for $30 a night. And here in Ibagué for about $50 a night. That difference was mainly for air conditioning. But ultimately, we decided to play three ITFs in a row with the boys and let them go city to city to city and see what it's like.
Great experience to see if one another country and to experience the tournament run in under a different organization with different, schedules, how they organize the tournament, when the tournament's run, and just gives you a little bit of different exposure to different competition. They're playing on red clay. They played in high altitude in Bogota, where altitude was over 8,500 feet. So a lot of just challenging conditions and something that they otherwise couldn't get in America. And like Robert said, really the only cost here was the airfare. The accommodations and food are so considerably less than in the U.S. It's not that much different than going to a tournament anywhere in the U.S.
Yeah, and I would add to that, not only is it not much more expensive, but even the airfare wasn't bad. I think the airfare was about $500 a person.
Which is what we spend going anywhere within the U.S.
Yeah, and so you think about, like, all right, are we going to go play a week tournament in Vegas? Each meal at night's going to cost $40 to $50. And here, just to give people an idea of the cost, yesterday I got one of the players two Gatorades and two waters, and the totals was $5.50. We just ate breakfast, and it was a full breakfast, me and Everett. Yeah, he got pancakes, he got eggs, he got fruit, he got a drink. I got coffee, I got pancakes. And all of that was $7, $7.50 maybe. So this idea that ITFs are way more expensive, I mean, sure, if you went to Paris, yeah, that's probably right. But coming to a place like this has been a blast. The culture's been fun. I've had to speak a lot of Spanish.
The kids have made great friends.
And
the kids have made great friends, too. There's kids from Brazil. There's kids from Chile, Peru that are in these tournaments. So there are the Colombians maybe stick to themselves a little bit, but the everyone else, the Americans are just as foreign as the the Brazilians.
But even like last night, the ride home we got was from a couple of Colombian folks that we've made friends with. So it's mostly the Colombian state themselves, but they also are very friendly. The people here are super friendly.
Right. Now, it's been a great experience and something that we're so far hasn't had any downside. You know, there wasn't really anything that we'd say, well, it's just not worth it to do this. You know, I think one of the things that I had in my mind that might be a downside was the fact that in the ITFs, it's single elimination, so you don't have a second guaranteed match. But Robert, tell us a little bit about what you experienced in the first tournament. I wasn't there. I just got for the second tournament. But how did kids deal with the tournament after they were eliminated, say, in the first round?
Yeah, I think one of my primary motivations for doing something like this was just my personal opinion that, and I've had other medical folks that confirm it, but my personal opinion that two singles, two doubles in one day, and then a following day of two singles, two doubles in the 16s and 18s is not healthy. You don't see any pros do that. So what's the alternative? Well, this is. So what do a lot of people in America, you know, the American way is bigger is better, right? The American way is bigger is better. More is better. So if one match is good, two's better, right? But I think for me, watching how this is done, you think about everybody that's here. You've got people from Brazil. You got people from all over the world. They're mainly coming with an academy and a coach. And they're all in the same boat. One match and they're out. So what do? Well, they all get together once they're put out and they train. They hit. They play sets. They compete. So it's almost like a little traveling circus of competitors. So what I noticed is once they get put out, they can get 3.5 hours of training. They can get as much training as they want once they're put out of the tournament. Does that make sense?
Yeah, true. And how did that training go? Was it organized by a coach or did the kids just get out there by themselves and figure it out? How did things look in Bogota with those kids that weren't playing after the first round?
Yeah, I think it was a mix of both, right? So you had some that were just kids going out there. They were hitting straight ahead. They were hitting cross court. But then then they would play a set against each other. Then you'd have coaches organize it. I'm going to be honest. I tried to just be close so that if it got a little sloppy, I could reorganize it. But for the most part, all these players are good and they're all high level and they're all focused and intense. And so you didn't have to do anything with them. They just went out there and they did exactly what they're supposed to do. And they wanted to do it. I think so that's the two match a day thing. So because all the players are at such a high level, it helps. So Scott, talk a little bit about the level of the players.
Right. So we're at a J30, which is really the intro level for ITFs. There's five levels, J60, J100,
300,
200, 300, and then the Grand Slams. So, you know, there is a very high level to this. J30 is where kids are trying to get on the boat, as we say. And so I would compare the level of a J30 here in Colombia to, you know, probably a high level four where you're in the semifinals. Or in national level three, in the qualifying, in the main draw is closer to a high, you know, the end of the L3 and L2. And it's one thing that's interesting is that the tournament here uses WTN for entry. And so we thought that, oh, well, WTN
secondary to points.
Yeah. After points, after ITF points, you get in based on your WTN. So we were thinking that, oh, well, you know, the WTN that we see in the U.S. would be similar to what we see here in Colombia because it's supposed to be universal. It's not.
Not even close.
It's not close.
I saw a 7 UTR kid that didn't make qualifying, 7 UTR now, that had a 28 WTN. That's crazy.
Right. And we've had, you know, other WTNs that, you know, were, say, below where my son is, but a much higher UTR. So the WTNs are kind of off.
I mean,
very off.
The culture here for the WTNs is we're on live and only to subscribers. They basically everyone here thinks they're, I'll use their word, they say they're shit.
Yeah.
The WTN.
Right. And, you know, and the problem with the UTR here in South America is that a lot of the kids play what the equivalent of the USTA would be is COSAD. and COSAD does not report into to UTR. So the UTRs don't have a lot of matches, and it's a little bit hard to get a feel for the UTRs. But I would say that, you know, all these kids that are in the qualifying are at least nines, between nines and tens. And then when we see in the main draw, you'll see tens and 11s.
Yeah, and one thing I'll say is I had an idea when we left the States that the UTRs were going to be inaccurate because of the WTNs. What I found is the UTRs are dead on. It's just the WTNs that are off. Because the kids that are in the ITF have been playing other ITFs, so their UTRs seem to be fairly – like, I haven't seen an upset yet in a match based on UTR. Like, oh, that kid will be that kid, and their UTRs are off. It's been fairly accurate.
And how hard is it to get into one of these if you don't have an ITF point?
Robert? Yeah, I think that was one of our biggest worries, because when you leave the States, you don't know if you're in or not.
Right.
Now, once you have an ITF point, you can get in any J30 pretty much. But
at least qualify.
Right, right. And for those out there listening, I would encourage you to go like Google. You can put in like ITF cutoffs, and it'll show you the cutoff ranking in 2023 for every ITF tournament that was played. And but here, unranked players made it in qualifying at Bogota, but then that means that it's prioritized based on WTN. So, I mean, I guess the answer to that question depends on what part of the world you're in. If you go to Florida, in say Orlando, you're going to have to be pretty highly ranked to get even in a J30. But here in South America, pretty much anybody with a WTN above maybe 25 or 24 is going to get in qualifying.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
Yeah.
The other thing that's kind of interesting is that the draw sizes are different for each one of the tournaments that we're going to be in.
48 in the first.
So in the first tournament, there was 48 in the main draw and 48 in the qual.
Or was it 48?
I think it was 48 and 32.
Yeah, yeah.
And then this tournament in Ibagué is 32 and 32, so a little bit tougher to get into. And then the last tournament in Pereira is 48 and 48. So that last tournament is your best chance, no matter what your UTR or WTN is.
To get in.
And so you got to look at the draw sizes. But like Robert said, there's an ITF page that shows what the last cutoff is for entry into main draw and qualifying. And that can give you a good idea. And you know, so for every tournament in 2023 for the across the world in the ITFs. And we'll put that below this in our Twitter feed. We'll add it to the Twitter feed so you can see that as well.
Yeah, so I say we stop for now and we record another one. The next one I want to record is the tournament experience. What's the officiating been like? What's the line calls been like? What's the behavior of the players been like? What have the parents been like? Well, so in the next one, we'll kind of reflect on, now that you're here, now that you got in, now it's time for your kid to compete. What's that like compared to being in America in a USTA tournament? All right, so we're here with part two of our reflection on Colombia. So
live from Ibagué, Colombia.
Yeah, so you'll hear trucks outside. You'll hear kids behind us. Yeah, it's raining. We're sitting here waiting on the next matches. So, Scott, just talk a little bit about the tournament experience. And for this part, we want to do tournament experience, thoughts on the officiating here. How are the officials doing? And remember, ITF is 13 to 18-year-olds, so this is just junior tennis, just like in America. Thoughts on the sportsmanship of the players, and then let's compare and contrast ITF to USTA. So first, talk about the ITF experience, the tournament experience you've seen.
It's a lot like how a pro tournament is organized and run. You've got check-ins, you've got the draws aren't posted. You know, if you're familiar with like a futures tournament, it's the same exact organization. You have check-ins the night before. You have an on-site alternates. Everybody's hoping to get in. So you know, as far as like the structure of the tournaments is very professional. It's very regimented in terms of how things are done. There's a very good rule book. One of the other things that we should point out is, before you can even sign up for an ITF tournament, every kid has to go through an ITF training course.
Actually, four of them.
Yeah, four of them. And there's four modules. And one of them is like on the structure of the tournaments and how you apply, how you get in.
How to get suspension points. Right. Get, yeah, all that.
All that stuff. So everyone sort of knows the rules and everyone sort of abides by it. And the referees are pretty, I think, you know, it hasn't really been any problems, but they're competent and they adhere to the rules and the process.
Yeah, to add to that, I would say the kids having to go through that training, it was around personal safety, right? How to interact with your coach, what's okay, what's not. How to interact with your parents, your players, your everything. Then they talk about the rules of the tournaments, right? So
before, how you get in, and then when this after, during the tournament.
And why that's so important, what Scott just said, is here the entry of a tournament is kind of the opposite of USTA. A kid, once they have their IPIN, so like their personal registration, they can go sign up for a tournament and not even pay. So you just sign up. So at USTA, what happens is nobody will sign up. And the day before the tournament, there'll be a million kids sign up an hour before the deadline. Well, ITS is kind of the opposite. Kids sign up like crazy just to kind of get it on their calendar. And then as they get closer, they have to withdraw before the withdrawal deadline. If they don't, they get suspension points. Well, the course explains all that to them. So they understand how a lucky loser works. They understand how an onside alternate works. They understand when they have to withdraw. The kids understand the rules so much better because they had to go through that course.
And that is one of the tricky things that when you do look at a tournament and you look at, you know, you sign up for a tournament and then the entry deadline comes, then you're going to see 100, you know, 200 kids will be signed up for the tournament and you're going to be like, you know, 85th on the alternate list and you think you have no chance to get into it. You know, and one of the other things is because there are so many tournaments under the ITF section or the ITF organization, that you have priorities. So you can sign up for multiple tournaments in the same week and you identify your priority 1, 2, or 3 as to which one you prefer to get into. And if you don't get your first priority, then you fall to the second, et cetera. That's why it's a little bit confusing to see where you really stand once the entry deadline hits. And then, you know, a week after the entry deadline is sort of like the deadline to withdraw. And then the week after that is like the freeze deadline when sort of the tournament is set. So it's sort of like, you know, you sign up for a tournament 3 weeks in advance, 2 weeks, then you have 1 week to withdraw. So 2 weeks before the tournament, you have a pretty good idea of where you are. Then a week before, you have this freeze deadline where the tournament is pretty much set. And then you sort of know where you are. But, you know, there's still a little bit of movement. But with our kids, you know, they started off in the first tournament. My son started off, you know, sort of midway on the alternate list. And by the time that the tournament happened, he was in the main draw. And so you just had to be patient with it and just sort of roll with it. And it's just, you just got to keep an eye on it and to see where it goes. But that's a big difference from the USTA.
Yeah. And I think the other thing about it that's neat is I think there's lots of access. So what I mean by that is if you're willing to come and you're willing to be here, there's a pretty good chance, unless your WTN's like 27 or 8, you're going to get in, at least to qualifying. And then once you're in qualifying, if you're good, you win into main draw, just like a pro tournament. I think another thing, talking about the applications, the main draw, the qualifying draw, and then the alternates, you got to kind of look above you and see how many of those kids put a tournament, because you prioritize the tournaments. This is my first priority, second priority, third. So how many kids have a priority of another tournament higher than this one, because they'll probably get in that one and then they'll move out of the way. And then also look how many of them are for way far away. So if they're from Sweden, for Colombia, they're probably not coming, so they're probably going to pull out. I do think the hard thing about it here is there's just a lot of time. I mean, I can't see how a kid who's not homeschooled can do this. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the main draw starts on Monday. The qualifying starts Saturday, Sunday. The qualifying, just as far as organization goes, you can have 2 matches in 1 day, and those matches, the qualifying matches, will be 2 out of 3 sets. The third set would be a tiebreaker, whereas in the main draw, you have 1 match per day, and it's 2 out of 3 full sets. So, you know, once that tournament starts on Monday, it's really, you know, for kids that have access to online education, or, you know, they have some sort of thing where they can travel during the week and still get their school done. But it makes it very, very different than the USTA, which does not have that kind of organization.
Yeah, and one thing I would say is this: you got to think of this a little bit different. Also, like USTA, if the tournament starts on Saturday, a lot of parents are going to get off work on Friday and drive to the tournament or fly to the tournament. They'll get there Friday night, play on Saturday. With this, if the qualifying draw starts Saturday, they might all get here on Wednesday or Thursday and train and hit and play and meet each other. And it's a true traveling circus of just kids and coaches. And I'll say this too, the majority of the kids here are not here with their parents. The majority are with a coach who's brought 8 to 10 kids. And so making it affordable, academies from Brazil and all over the world, Florida, everywhere. So the kids are doing their, like, literally we're looking at kids right now doing their, or should be doing their school online. They were, but they quit now. Just on their laptop, online education. So this is one of those get here, and then you're just going to be here for a while.
And that's another thing that Robert mentioned is a good point of getting to the tournament early. In our case, coming from the U.S. to Bogota, the elevation was a huge adjustment. And so to get here on Wednesday, you know, it gave them 4 days to prepare for the main draw to, you know, get acclimated to the altitude, adjust the stringing. You know, one of the things that you don't really necessarily think about is, you know, adjusting your stringing. So he had to, you know, up the tension about 5 pounds, find out what the right comfort level was, so a little bit of trial and error. But those are the kind of things that really help when you come to a foreign country for the first time, is to get there a little bit early, get acclimated to the conditions, you know,
the money, the food,
and the red clay. You know, we're playing on red clay. We don't really have that in the U.S. So altitude, red clay were huge adjustments for our kids coming here. And, you know, to come on a Friday night and start playing on Saturday would not have been a smart idea.
And it's so cheap, there's really no need to do that anyway, right? I mean, the only thing that would stop you is the time. This is where I would encourage, if you've got a 15, 16-year-old and the coach is taking 10 kids, let your child go. You know, let them go and see the world and experience this. The parents don't necessarily have to be that. I think that's one of the biggest. So when you think about ITF versus USTA contrast, I think that's one of the biggest ones I've noticed. A lot less parents around. A lot less.
And, you know, one of the other things is, you know, coming to a country like Colombia, you know, if people haven't, you know, really done a lot of research on it, you know, they're probably thinking it's the Colombia from Narcos, you know, it's
the 80s and 90s.
And, you know, to be honest, the tournament experience here is during the day, you get up and you come to the tournament, you stay at the tournament pretty much all day, and you go home and you eat. So you're not really that exposed to the outside world. Here, where it's very, you know, similar to the U.S. And all the clubs that we've been to have everything. So restaurants, gyms, you know,
bowling alleys,
pool tables, etc. Fishing ponds.
So you can literally just come and stay all day.
So there's literally nothing that they don't have that they don't want to do, and you know, so you don't really feel like you're just going, you know, in a car, in an apartment, and at the tennis club. So there is a little bit of more to the experience than just the tennis.
Yeah, I would say the clubs in Colombia are very much. You can tell they were built so that families could come with mom, dad, and kids and stay all day. Dad might play golf, the kids might swim, the kids might play soccer, the tennis, bowling, eating. The mom might go in the fitness center, she might play tennis.
They even have a salon.
Yeah, they got it. You can get your hair cut. The one in Bogota had like a little mini mall where you could get dessert and shop and. So the clubs here are built to do more than just play tennis and play golf. They're built for you to come and literally stay all day long. And the one here in Ibagué even has cabins where if you wanted to stay on site, you literally would never even have to leave. You know, one of the things I emailed the tournament director just wondering, like, is it safe? I didn't know. And he said, just go from your Airbnb to the club and you'll be fine. And in Bogota, that was good advice. I would say in Ibagué, we've gotten out, we've gone around the town, walking malls, and Ibagué is, I mean, I wouldn't say it's like America, but I have felt here as safe as I feel walking around Tulsa, Oklahoma. Yeah. Would you say the same?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, so I haven't felt uncomfortable. So Scott, let's talk just a little bit about the officiating. You know, one of the topics in America that comes up a lot is, and I'm going to use air quotes, but kids cheating, right? And we've heard the research that 70% of poor calls, the kid truly believes it. 20%, their eyes and brain trick them into it. So you're really only trying to win 10% of those bad calls. But in America, that's a big conversation. Like, I would bet you listen to a conversation of two kids come off, and the one that lost 99% of the time is going to say the other one
cheated.
He cheated me. So talk a little bit, and then also the officiating in America is substandard. and that's just me trying to put it as nice as I can. So what does the officiating look like here, and what does the cheating look like here?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, just talk to the officiating. In America, you don't get a sense that a lot of the officials understand tennis, that they don't have a tennis background. They may have been trained to be officials as a way to make some money on the weekends. But you hear a lot of comments, you know, like, oh, you should never do that or whatever. And it's like you see it happen all the time in college and pro tennis. Here, you know, like I said, there is a language barrier, so we don't really hear everything that they're saying. But they seem to be more accepting of some behaviors that some officials in the U.S. would find intolerable and objectionable. But at the same time, I haven't seen really anybody, any kid do anything that would warrant, you know, anything that would be a major suspension or.
We've seen a kid throw a racket.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the official just goes over and tells them not to do it, and that's the end of it.
Yeah, and they get a warrant. And that's another thing with the ITF rules. In the USTA, that's an automatic point penalty and 2 points on your violation. In ITF, it's a warning is 1 point, and you have to get 10 points to get a suspension. So it's,
and the suspensions here are much shorter; they're like a month.
Right, right. And so it's a little bit more accepting of behavior that is common on professional college tennis. But you know, with respect to the line call, since we are playing on red clay, the marks are checked. And so that eliminates a lot.
But explain what that means.
All right. So on a clay court.
Two kids. You got kid A, kid B.
Yeah. So you have, you know, kid A hits a ball close to the line. The other kid calls it out. He points to a mark. The other kid can come across the net, look at the mark.
They're literally standing over each other.
They're literally standing over.
Both looking at the mark together.
Right. And then if they don't agree, then they call a referee. Referee comes over, examines the mark, and then they make a decision.
Just so like you see in the French Open. It
exactly,
looks just like that.
Exactly. And so, and the other kid accepts it. I've never seen one where a kid was like throwing a tantrum afterwards. Like they respect the decision and they move on. A lot of times the kid will come over, he'll see the mark, you know, be like, okay, good call or whatever. And then go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say there's a lot of times where you'll see a kid call it and then that kid will go inspect the mark and then just tap the racket and give it to them. So they thought it was out, but once they look at the mark, they realize it's in. And I'll tell you what I've enjoyed is more than that. And I've said there's not a lot of parents, but there's a lot of Colombian parents here, the Brazilian, the American, not as many, but the Colombian parents, when the official inspects the mark with both boys and makes the call or both girls, the parents are good with it too.
Yeah.
Like you don't hear any parents, that kid's a cheater, this kid's a cheater, my kid got you. There's none of that, those conversations. The official came over, looked at the mark, we move on.
Yeah. And you know, one of the kids that we're here with, Mahan, he did something really smart. So if you're ever in this situation, you know, there was a dispute over to which mark was the right mark. And there were the two marks. One was a mark that was like going straight ahead, and one mark was going sideways. So it was like, let's say that, you know, he had a forehand cross court and that ball was landed on the line or just wide. And the other one would have been, say, a backhand down the line where the ball went straight. And so the referee was able to ask the boys what direction did the ball come from. And then by that, the referee was able to identify what the correct mark was. So just something that
– And then gave Mahan the point.
Right, right. So something that an experienced referee that understands tennis would be able to distinguish the two marks and where the ball came from was really impressive.
Yeah, I thought that was super impressive. One of the things I really like about the way ITF operates too is they put up the draw and then they assign each section of the draw a court. So, and here's what that means is instead of you looking at a USTA draw and your kid plays at 10 o'clock and it's at X facility, But there's two matches before them. You know it's probably not going to be 10, but you still have to get there. You got to do the warm-up because it says 10 on the draw. Here, it'll say these three matches are going to be on court one. These other three matches are going to be on court two. And then you might be second on court one. Well, you can literally see a match happening on the court you play on next, and you know, I don't play right now. I can go warm up. So I think it makes it a lot easier for timing and parents and to know. But I think the main thing it does, since we're at one club and not multiple facilities, is if you're a coach bringing players, you're not having to take them to four different facilities today. Everyone comes here. Coach comes here. Everyone eats breakfast in the same place. Everybody just stays here all day long. I think this is more conducive for travel coaches that want to bring a whole bunch of kids.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%, because it is self-contained. You know, the matches are very structured. Like Robert said, there is an order of play that's established, just like you go to any challenger.
Pro tournament,
same thing. You're on court five and you're the fourth on, so you sort of have a sense of, okay, I need to be here. And they'll have not before times, so it's not outrageous if, you know, there's two pullouts or something like that where you're stuck. But you know, you got to keep an eye on your court, you know, understand sort of where that those courts matches are. It can be on later than you think, or it could be on earlier, but you know where you're going to play and in what order you're going to play. So I think it's a little bit better.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think and then to talk a little bit about the officiating, I think Scott said it really well, but I think the main thing it comes down to is what I've seen. And this is my main theme, is the officials are not adversarial to the kids. The officials understand that if not for the kids, there's no tournament, so they're not making the money. And they almost come at it with a spirit of helpfulness. Like, I'm here to help. I'll give you an example. One of the kids that we brought was playing another kid. We weren't even over there at first. And one of the coaches was coaching the player. And so the official proactively went over and told him to stop, and then sat there for the entire remainder of the match to prevent the coach from coaching the player. In America, that coach comes over, says stop, and then walks off and says, well, I've got five courts. I can't stay on one court. Even though they're not being called to another court, they just don't want to do the work. I think the official here, it's just a spirit of helpfulness. I mean, even last night, Mahin Cramps, he's here for 3 hours. One of the last kids to leave gets an IV, and the officials are the ones coming in, checking on him. One of them even sets up the IV for him. Just a spirit of helpfulness. You know, in America, it seems almost like, I can't wait for this to be over so I can go home. And here the officials just want to be here to help the kids.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, I think one of the things is, you know, there's, six courts that we're using for the tournament?
6 to 8, something
And there's 3 or 4 officials. You know, there's a tournament director, there's tournament referee, but I think there's like 3 or 4 roving people that will go around, so that there's a good ratio that can pay more attention to a court that needs the attention. So,
yeah. And when the attention's needed, they stay there and give it.
Right. Yep.
So that, for this one, that was tournament experience, thoughts on officiating, thoughts on sportsmanship. I think the kids have all treated each other really well. And then the ITF versus USTA comparison. Is there anything when you compare ITF and USTA left?
Well, yeah, I think we talked about it in the previous podcast or the previous
Twitter spaces
that we did on Twitter, was that, you know, I think the obvious thing is just the consolation versus no consolation and how you deal with that. And I think there's some pros and cons with that. You know, obviously, you know, more matches are a good thing. But there's also, you also get more training in, you know, because the kids do find ways to train during that downtime, so you have more variety of match play.
Creates a collegiality where the kids aren't me against you also.
Right. And so, yeah, it takes a little bit of the edge off the tournament and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, like I say, I think I tend to like at least 2 matches per tournament. It seems like it's somewhat tough to maybe travel a long way and spend money to, and then potentially only have 1 match. But if you stick around, you can get a lot out of that time that you spend there. Not sure how, if you plan to stay in the entire week, but stay 3 or 4 days, you're going to get plenty of training. So if you're from an area that doesn't have a lot of clubs or academies, or you're seeing the same kids all the time, if you stick around for, you know, 2 or 3 more days, you have plenty of opportunities to practice, to hit, to do some practice matches and work on some things. And again, because a lot of the coaches are here running with the kids, they're going to find those opportunities. They're not going to let the kids just sit around and not do anything.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things I've noticed about Americans that's interesting versus the rest of the world, and I think the reason ITF works in the rest of the world versus maybe struggles in America, is Americans want it to be very overt and clear what their plans are, right? So, like, Scott, you may get a hotel and you want to know, I'm checking in on this day, I'm checking in on that day. Tomorrow, I'm leaving the Airbnb at this time, I'm arriving. And I think ITF is more of an organic thing. Like, so think about it. Let's say you come here. Let's say your kid comes here and gets beat in the second round of quali, right? So wins the first round on a Saturday, loses the second round on Sunday, because they'll do 2 rounds in quali, but it may not be on Saturday. For example, here, they did 1 round Saturday, 2 on Sunday, and your kid gets put out on Sunday. If you stay Monday through, say, Friday, and you organically show up, hunt, practice matches, you're going to get what an academy in America would charge, $750 for that week. But in America, we want to know, we're arriving at this time, we're leaving at this time, and this is what we're getting. But here, you could have played Saturday, Sunday, and then you could have trained Monday through Friday completely for free and got $750 worth of training totally free. You just have to be willing to not know that when you put your head down on Sunday night what Monday's going to look like, but just show up and make it happen.
So, Robert, so what do they charge you when you showed up in Bogota and Ibagué before the tournament to train on the courts?
Not a penny. They acted like we were celebrities. They were so thankful. They gave us the primary court. They swept it. They did everything. And we tried to pay, and they wouldn't let us. The fact that we were in the tournament, it's almost like you're welcome here until you decide to leave because you're part of the tournament.
Right. And that's a big difference in the U.S. The U.S., will find a way to get $25 out of your pocket for playing on an outdoor court the day before the tournament.
Oh, Disney World. They're going to get every penny they can.
Yeah. So, you know, that's another big term. It's just the culture of hospitality and camaraderie.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have known that, but the pro at Tucker, Chris Kennedy, told me. He was like, yeah, most of these clubs, no matter where in the world you do this, that are hosting an ITF, understand that the culture of it is this way. Yeah. You want to talk about it, sponsors? And talk about also... So I want you to talk about signage, but I also want to talk about the fact that they didn't just do an ITF. Like in Bogota, they did ITF, they did COSAT at the same time, and they did Futures 15,000. And so, you know, I've heard a lot of Americans say that ITFs are money pits, but if you married it with a USTA tournament for the kids that got put out of the ITF, you can make some money there.
Right.
Then you throw futures in there,
and
then they're making money on food and everything.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, like I said, just looking at the courts, you know, we see signage on all the courts. So again, you know, when we talk about the sort of a professional feel of a tournament, is, you know, between the courts they've got banners that separate the two courts that are side by side.
And we'll put a picture of those on Twitter.
Yeah, and on the fences behind and on the sidelines, you have Kia, you've got LATAM Airlines,
is like their American Airlines,
right? You've got, you know, the Aerosport and COSAT and, you know, the Federation and you know, ITF. So it has that feel and has that look of a serious professional tournament. We go to tournaments in the U.S., there's no effort put into making the tournament feel like it's anything special.
Well, so for me, I think this club views this tournament as something special to host. And this country loves tennis. So even the crowds have been bigger. I mean, the first match Everett played in Bogota, there were 100 people watching that match, at least. I mean, we've had adults that show up that are members of this club. They're coming to watch the best 15, 16-year-olds in their country compete. And where in America, you go to a Futures and a Challengers where you're watching elite top 500 players, and there's like 3 people in the stands. So I think part of it is, too, this country just loves tennis. You know, and this, yeah, they love sport, and they take this tournament serious, and the whole club has come together to make this a positive. Where in America, what you see a lot is one tournament director, because they're making all the money for the tournament, put it on. The members don't like it because they lose court time, and so it's like, hey, just come, just play your matches, and the faster you leave, the better. Is kind of where here, it just. They, you can tell, it almost feels like a U.S. Open feel, not like a U.S. Open, but they know they're going to get this once a year, and they did it right, and next year when they have it, they'll do it right again.
All right, so we're here for part three of our, kind of our J30, Bogota, Ibagué, and Pereira traveling in Colombia experience. Right now, what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about the logistics. What does Uber look like? What is in-country travel? What did the flights look like? All that type of stuff. So, Scott, you want to kick it off?
Yeah. So, you know, when we did this trip, you know, we obviously had to book flights. And, you know, looking at the flights coming from places like Louisville and Tulsa to Colombia, obviously no direct flights. So, there shouldn't be any direct flights. So, you know, but really the prices weren't bad. You know, I haven't flown too much recently, but all the prices are now, you know, basic economy, premium economy, et cetera. And, you know, Robert, you decided to do basic economy.
Yeah.
And that flight was about 500 round trip.
Yep. Per person.
And so, yeah, per person. And, I did a, maybe the upgrade of to one, which allowed me to choose my seat and, you know, have a little bit of flexibility on that. I don't think I needed it, but you know, I did it, and it cost me, so mine was about 600 round trip. You know, so what advice would you give when you're coming to travel with the purpose of playing tournaments for 3 weeks, not a whole lot of, you know, sightseeing and things like that, in terms of, you know, what do you need as far as luggage and bags? Because when you start adding bags and the prices start to go up a little bit more and you can't do that basic economy, was it worth it?
Yeah, I think it depends on how predictable first on the flight the results of the kids you're with are. If you have a kid that you think can win the whole tournament, that's a little more predictable. So what I would say if I were changing it, I did basic economy and I booked the flights round trip. What I would do different is we knew when we were coming. So go basic economy here and just book it as a one way. And then, because the price is half of what we paid, but then the flight back, book it as just regular economy where you're allowed free changes. Yeah. And so, you know, when you're coming, so book when you're coming, bait the cheapest it has, but then the return, book a flight that allows changes. Yeah. What else were we talking about?
Well, just luggage
and. Oh yeah. One of the things, you know, I travel some for work, and I've gotten where I don't check any bags. I just refuse to check a bag. They lose them too much. They really damage the bags a lot. So one thing I told the boys was you get a backpack, and then no tennis bags, just a backpack and like a duffel bag. And so the boys have used the duffel bag for their tennis rackets as their tennis bags while they're here. But traveling here, they basically put all their luggage in that duffel bag with their rackets with the grips hanging out. And I just told them, look, because sometimes you'll get on a flight and on your way on, they'll say, hey, there's no more overhead bin space. And so they want to take your bag there, and then it's right back there when you get out of the plane. But I told them, if that happens, just grab your rackets and put them in your backpack. In other words, don't let the rackets out of your sight. You don't want to get here and the bag gets lost and you don't have rackets to play. And I think this worked out pretty well. Do you?
Yeah, I agree. And I think also the key to it is having accommodations that have washers and dryers, or at least washers. If you're staying in a hotel, you probably don't have access to a washer unless you do laundry through the hotel service, which is pretty expensive. But that was another key thing that Robert did, was he was able to find Airbnbs in each of the locations that we're going to be in that had laundry, that had, you know, we went the Airbnb route. And talk a little bit about, you know, why we chose Airbnbs and how economical it was.
Yeah, I think it's a little harder to choose Airbnbs because you don't know how safe the neighborhood is that you're booking in. So you got to really read the reviews and stuff. But In each city, we booked a 3-bedroom, 2-bath at least location. And it was funny when we were looking, the one in Bogota was $30 or $32 a night. The one
wait,
here.
Wait. $32 a night?
Per night, yeah,
that's for the whole thing, not the per whole, person?
No, for the whole thing. And you know, on Airbnb, you can filter by the amenities. So I made sure to choose one with a washing machine. In Bogota, they're really, I couldn't find anywhere that had dryers. It was all just washers. And in Bogota, I couldn't find anywhere that had air conditioners. But in Praia, it's a little warmer. It's a little more humid. So we did one with an air conditioner, and the washer's one of these all-in-one washer dryers. That's been nice. Here in Praia, it was like 52 a night. Of course, we got three kids, so we split it all three ways. So in Bogota, the 32 a night came out to like $10.25 a person per night, which also gave us some flexibility. Like, we tacked on an extra night in Bogota that we ended up not using, but it was $32, so no big deal. And then Ibagué was 52. Then Pereira is somewhere around 65. Apparently, it's more of a touristy type area. Yeah. And finding places, I mean, there were places $200 and $300 a night. So we were lucky to find one as cheap as we did. But I wanted to make sure that the thing that was important to me was to have a washer and dryer, or at least a washer. In Bogota, we had to wash it and then hang it. And we're making a video for like a series of videos for this trip that we'll put on our YouTube channel. But you can see kind of how we got laundry spread all over the place. But yeah, I think the Airbnb route's a little bit easier than the hotel route. Having to have 2 hotel rooms and all that kind of stuff would have gotten expensive.
Yeah, and you know, and if you're familiar with Airbnbs, you're living in someone's apartment, so you have a lot more space. In a hotel, you just have that one room that everyone's stuck in, so it's not very accommodating for a week at a time. So, I mean, highly recommend the Airbnb route for these kind of things. We also ended up buying fans, little portable fans that we put in the rooms. Helped out immensely because the air conditioner is only in the living room.
And they don't do fans here for some reason.
Right, right. So, just a way to make the nights a little bit more easy to sleep.
We spent like $25 or $30 on the fan, and it was worth every
penny. Yep, worth every peso.
Yeah, every peso. So what's next?
We talk about, well, how about the Ubers? Just the cost of it. So, you know, one of the things that you're not renting a car here, so you got to get around.
I would say don't rent a car. If you're thinking about coming, don't rent a car.
Yeah, the rules of the road here are not
anything. The lines are optional.
Right, exactly. Lines are optional and not – you have people walking, literally walking in the left-hand lane down a busy, busy thoroughfare.
And you got motorcycles. We'll post that in the videos on YouTube so people can see. It's just wild, the traffic.
Motorcycles, electric rickshaws, people with wheelbarrows. So it's
dogs, animals, anything you can imagine are in the road. Cyclists, a lot of bicyclists.
Right, right. So anyways, do not drive. Get an Uber. Ubers here are uber cheap.
I mean, today's trip was just coming to – from the club back here, which is about 20
minutes.
Yeah, and it was 15,000 pesos, so divided by 4 is somewhere around 375 or 390 for the Uber. So, I mean, just they're so cheap. Like, I tip the max every time, and the max tip they'll allow is like $1.25.
Right.
But it's, I think Uber's the best, definitely the way to go. One thing I'll say, though, is if you're coming, Uber's not legal from the airport. So when you get picked up at the airport, you're going to have to get a taxi. Or if you know somebody here, like when we first got here with the boys, we got here late at night, 9:45, weren't through customs till like 11. But one of the coaches at the academy knew somebody, and they picked us up and took us. So that helped because the taxi drivers, they're only going to take cash. And, taxi drivers are taxi drivers.
Right, and so when I flew into Ibagué, I met them here in Ibagué, and I thought I would call an Uber, and the Uber found out I was at the airport. He said he couldn't do it, so then I jumped into a cab, not realizing, and once I got into the cab and he took off, I asked if I could pay with a card, and he said no, cash only. So we had a little bit of a scramble to get, you know, some cash on the run. And so that's another thing is just, you know, I haven't really needed cash for anything other than that. But it might be just good to take out a couple, you know, $100 worth of pesos in the airport when you get in, just to have something in your pocket in case for something that might pop up.
Well, you haven't had to use cash much, but Luke has.
Okay.
Right? I mean, to pay for the Bogota tournament, he had to pay, it was 215,000 pesos, which 215,000 pesos equates to like $55. He then, when we got to Ibagué, that it was another 220,000 pesos, which, you know, it's funny how the conversions work, that 220,000 pesos was $55 also.
Yeah.
But 5,000 pesos is what, a dollar? So it's $1.25. So, and then stringing at Bogota, the stringer would only take cash. So cash is important to get. I would say one thing I wouldn't have done is do a conversion at the airport. There's ATMs at the airport. So one thing I did is I went to a website called Wise.com, W-I-S-E.com, and I got a travel, a travel debit card. And it'll convert the money to anything, and you can add cash to it at any time. And I keep $200 or less on it, so if it gets lost or someone gets it or steals the card number, I don't care. On the app, you can lock the PIN and all kind of different stuff, and you can limit the amount of money that's spent a day. So it's really cool. I would just tell people, I would encourage folks to get one of those. I wouldn't use my personal debit card here because you just don't want – if you've got thousands of dollars, you don't want people to have access to that money. But I would recommend when you land at the airport, just go straight to an ATM, take out, I think 600,000 at most ATMs is the maximum, 600,000 pesos, that's which is about, well, it's not an even conversion because they charge you 7% for the, well, they charge you 27,000 pesos just to use it, which is what?
$4,
and then they charge you a 7% or 7.5% markup on the conversion, so it actually ends up being about $175.
Yeah, I'm sorry, $27,000 is more like $8.
Yeah, and so you end up spending like $178, $179 to get out 600,000 pesos, which is about $150, $160 worth of pesos, but you're going to pay some fees. We watched a video when we first got here, and they said everything's cash culture, and that's somewhat true in smaller markets. But we're in a pretty modern era spot. Like at the club, we've been able to pay card at the mall here. But now this morning we ate breakfast and didn't even ask, and then they wanted cash.
Right.
By the way, all of us, five of us ate breakfast. We all had drinks. We all had a full plate of food, five of us, and the total was about 10 bucks, 42,000 pesos.
Not an exaggeration.
Yeah,
it was so incredible. Cheap. Yeah, so cheap. So let's talk about. So to use your cell phones here, when you come from America, your plan probably does not include international. Before we left, I went to AT&T, got them to convert our phones to international for 2 weeks. Sometime we're going to be here. It was $10 a day.
But maximum of 10 days.
Maximum of 10 days. So if you're here for 21 days, you're only paying $100.
Which is what's happening with us.
Yeah, and so you did the same thing?
Yeah, I did the same thing. I just went on the AT&T app and chatted with them and had them add international.
Okay.
And I just had them leave it. Like, they said, we can turn it back off. I said, if I don't use international, do you charge it? And they said, no.
Oh.
So basically, I left it on. So from now on, I don't have to call ahead.
Okay.
If I go international.
And if you don't do that, when you get here, you have to get a SIM card.
Yeah, and I didn't really want to do all
that. Yeah, because that has limits on, you know, how much data you can use. And you're coming here, you don't have, you know, you don't know.
You have a different number. You got to do a different WhatsApp.
It's a lot of hassle when there's an easier solution.
I agree.
Yeah. All right. What do you think of the language barrier? I've struggled with it a lot because my second natural language is Italian, which just means talk louder and use your hands.
Use your hands more.
So it hasn't really worked for me, but it's. But go ahead.
Yeah, one of the first things I did when we were on the Everett. Where were we? Were we on the Houston airport when I showed you all the Translate app? So I had all the boys in the Houston airport, and I showed them the Translate app, and I showed them all the features in it, like. You can put in English, it'll convert it to Spanish, it'll speak it out loud, you can have a conversation with it. It'll even let you take a picture of something and then
like
just
a menu.
Like a menu, and it'll just convert everything for you right then. That's been huge.
I would say my Spanish is good enough to get around. It's super broken, but I can ask, like, where's the bathroom? I can order food. I can ask to pay, all that kind of stuff. But I would say if you're coming to Colombia, it really helps if you can speak Spanish. Yes. Like, very few English speakers here.
True. Yeah. 100%. And you're dealing with, you know, Uber drivers, restaurant workers, that, you know, that's where you probably want to have some of those language skills, because that's where you're probably having your most communication. And that's where I've struggled the most.
It's funny, in America, when someone doesn't speak English, we just talk louder.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that happening to us here.
Right.
I think it was good for the boys, because they were like, man, I'm going to be nicer to the kids in America that don't necessarily speak English, that are new to the country.
Yeah.
Because it's not that they're not smart. It's just they don't understand.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a good reflection for the boys.
Yeah. So I think that covers a lot of the things that I thought would, if I'm a first-time traveler coming to Colombia to play some ITFs, things that I'd want to consider, think about. Anything else that...
A few others. I would say make sure that you read all the requirements to enter the country. I haven't taken my passport anywhere with us while we're here. I've just taken a picture on my phone, and everybody's taken that picture on the phone.
Right.
I didn't want to lose it. It stayed at the Airbnb the whole time. And I would also say, I watched a lot of YouTube videos about the country, and I think that's smart. Like, I just showed you that Twitter video of the guy that went to Turks and Caicos, accidentally left a bullet in his bag, and then is facing 12 years in prison. I think it's important for people to realize you're not in America. Learn about the country before you come, and follow their rules, because they don't have to follow American rules.
Right, right. There's something I was going to add to that, but I forgot what it was. So,
but I would say that I recommend this. This has been fun.
Yeah, no, I was just going to point out, when we do go to the restaurants and we're at the club, they require a form of ID when you order. I guess people skip out on bills or something. So we have our driver's licenses, and every day they take it down our driver's license.
Driver's license number, whatever.
Right, yeah.
Or you can show a picture of your passport.
Right, right, right. But you need some sort of ID, some places to order food. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think the way we look at things in America, like, everywhere we've driven, there are giant walls and fences around the home.
With electric wire.
Electric wire. I mean, security here, you can tell, is when someone's building a property, they're thinking about, how am I going to keep people out of here?
Right.
And in America, it's funny, talking to one of the Uber drivers, he went to Florida, and he was like, he couldn't believe, like, I could just walk in their yard, and no one would stop me. And so I think they have worked really hard around security here, but it's because you have such a have and have nots situation.
Yeah.
And so I think when you're walking the street, you got to be, try not to look like you're rich.
Right.
You know, try to fit in, try to blend in. We haven't worn, we've been very much in sweatshirts, and I mean, we stand out anyway. But I don't think we've walked around looking like we have millions of dollars, and so nobody really bothers us.
Yeah.
And I will say, there's a big misconception about safety. I have not felt unsafe, but it is an adjustment. Like, your eyes, what you see driving down the road looks different than it does in the States. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. It's, you know, you drive down, when we drive from the Airbnb to the club, you see some really interesting neighborhoods. A lot of stuff going on there, and stuff that you probably wouldn't feel comfortable walking around in.
No. Well, and even the club the boys hit in last night. I mean, it's literally a club like a field.
Yeah.
And not even a club. It's 6 courts in a field. And then there's like a chicken coop with chickens. I mean, it's just, to me, the theme of this country is find a way to eat. And then you got people at the very top that are living really, really good.
Yeah. No, it's a very interesting culture. It's a beautiful country.
Gosh, so pretty.
The mountains everywhere. You're basically playing in the clouds. The clouds are, you know, right eye level with you. It's pretty amazing scenery. Beautiful country. So I think that's all I've got for this.
And one thing I think we should do is one more after this one, where we talk about what the actual tennis was like in each city, as far as the altitude in Bogota and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll get to that. But if you don't have anything else, we'll wrap it up with it.
Sounds good.
All right. Bye.
giving me wind and rain. You're some kind of butterfly. Baby, you get me feel lighter. You whip up my appetite. Don't leave me high and dry. Yeah.